folks. This is Jim French.
This is Ted Diamond.
And this is the Awareness Connection Podcast, a podcast where we talk about health and human development, the human body, and mind-body awareness. And this is going to be a continuation of our series on the topic of developmental movement. We've been speaking a lot about this, and we've been saying how interesting and rich and variegated this subject is. And the fact that we're having another episode here just shows. So we've also been discussing, Ted, you and I were speaking before the episode about, you know, just in case anyone was unclear so far about where you stand on your understanding or your utilization or your position within the subject of developmental movement. Today's a good day to talk about, to really stamp clearly what you think the fundamental issues or like the fundamental topics are when we speak about developmental movement. And we're going to bring in a couple of names today. We'll be talking about some people as well, but we're really going to be talking about upright posture, you know, the fully human upright posture, the bipedal primate posture, which is unique, it seems. So yeah, I just wanted to start it off by saying that. So
yeah, I think if you're interested in the subject of movement and movement awareness, there's so many ways of approaching it, but I think one of the elements that began to give meaning to the whole subject was the idea of upright posture. Mm-hmm. Because in our human upright form, we're unique among all the animals. And this applies to developmental movement as well, because when you're speaking about developmental movement, it's easy to go back and look at all these primitive movements thinking that somehow by recapitulating the past, you're going to magically function better in our upright form. But the truth is that you also have to have an understanding of the upright form in order to intelligently look at the earlier stages. Mm. And I think that from that point of view, developmental movement is really interesting because if you don't just look at it as a way of just sort of going back to the past and trying to arrive at the present, but if you look at the movements as a series of stages going toward upright, then you can make sense of both ends of it better. And I thought that it would be interesting to speak a little bit about the upright posture and specifically about Raymond Dart, because he had such interesting insights about upright posture.
Great. Yeah. Yeah. So we can, you know, we can talk about upright posture, we can situate that within an evolutionary context. We can bring in this theorist, medical anatomist, Raymond Dart, who will also be familiar to people who have studied developmental movement. This is sort of a bring it together episode. This will probably be the last episode on this subject that we record, and then we're going to move on to other topics next podcast.
Yeah, and this is also, maybe this will bring us towards some other related topics as well.
Yeah. But,
yeah, I think, so we were discussing this, but I think Raymond Dart was interested in developmental movement because he had a daughter and a son who had coordination difficulties. I think the daughter had was having, night terrors, as they called it in those days. And I think the son had some issues with spasticity. And I think Dart himself had maybe scoliosis, I forget. But he had issues, and he felt that learning about movement was going to be helpful. So he had a personal interest. So, and then he also develop procedures that he applied, and I think he did with his kids. But even apart from that, it's his own professional background that's so interesting here, because he was an anatomist and was hired to, I think run the anatomy program at the medical school, at a medical school in South Africa. I think he was Australian.
Yeah. If I remember correctly, he was running the gross anatomy lab.
Yeah.
You know, for medical trainees,
medical students.
So yeah, highly developed.
And he was obviously very knowledgeable about anatomy. Mm-hmm. But because of the popularity of evolutionary theory in those days, being in Africa,
this was like when, more or less, 20s, 30s, 40s.
Was it the 30s? We'll check. Yeah.
I'm going to check.
Yeah. Because of the popularity of evolutionary theory and Darwin and being in Africa, he learned about a nearby quarry that would sometimes unearth different fossils. And he was interested in that. So he asked the people at the quarry if they would, you know, if they ran into any fossils, bring them to him. And from now, you know, time to time, they bring him, I don't know, they find baboon bones, fossils, and he'd look them over. And one day he saw a small skull was brought to him that looked to him like a baboon skull, a very small skull. But being pretty, you know, free thinking, he looked at it and determined pretty quickly that this was not a baboon, because it had a very human looking jaw and teeth. And the shape of the skull was such that the hole where the spine exited, the foramen magnum, the hole in humans is underneath the skull, and that in other animals is sort of more to the back, he noticed that this hole was situated at a place that could only be accounted for if you put this as being an upright creature with the skull sitting on top.
This is about 1924 when this skull.
Yeah, 20s, 20, okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, he began to work on this. He had to sort of chip away at this to get to the bone and to look at this thing in more detail. And he was convinced that he was looking at a very early human being, or proto-human being, an animal that was no longer partially upright, but had gone fully upright, with the skull sitting on top, with a very small skull, a very small brain case. And he determined that this was a early human. He was attacked for this because, for two reasons. Number one, a lot of the big figures in the field didn't want to believe that the first humans came from Africa. They wanted to think that they came from Europe, particularly from England. And also, people wanted to believe that the human being had a large brain, and that maybe that the large brain case preceded upright posture. And what his skeleton showed, or his skull showed, was that this creature had a small brain case, rather like a chimpanzee, but had gone upright first. And he was attacked by the you know, medical anthropological establishment, and it took many years with a colleague for them to unearth other skulls to finally convince people that this really was indeed an upright primate, the earliest of the upright primates, now known as Australopithecus.
And this was a decades long period, from what I remember, that he was like, attacked and ignored, and it was 30, just sort of an amazing thing.
Yeah. 30 you years.
Know? Yeah.
It's, yeah. Later like, on, they found whole skeletons of the whole, you know, and those mm-hmm. people got more notoriety because now they found a whole, what clearly was like an early human.
Yeah.
And Dart had only found the skull or other fragments, but this was still an amazing find, because it was perhaps the earliest person who discovered the early prototypes of human beings in Africa.
So just to say again, Ted, you know, Darts brought this fossil skull. This was probably in the southern region of Africa. He was in a South African university. And the skull was easily mistaken for like a baboon, you know, small brain case. Maybe different type of teeth, you know. I'm not entirely sure about that.
It didn't have the fangs that you see in a chimpanzee or a baboon.
Interesting.
It had much more like the flattened teeth of humans. Yeah.
Very interesting. Very interesting that this goes hand in hand. But the hole in the skull out of which the spinal cord runs, the foramen magnum, the big hole, was in a location at the bottom of the skull, as opposed to other animals, you know, like a cat, it's in the back. And so
more like in the back. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, Raymond Dart recognizes this fact, probably among others, but it was mainly this fact about this skull that led him to say, or that led him to really conclude, this is a fully upright.
Yeah. Instead of the spine being, let's say like this with the skull, let's say here, the foramen magnum was under here, which means that the spine was here, which means that the thing was standing up fully upright with free use of the arms.
Yeah.
And then he developed a theory that this early creature was able to make tools, was violent, was able to use bones to hit. And, you know, some of his, you know, ideas on that were later debunked, but the basic idea of uprightness, he was fascinated by it. And it became part of his interest in movement, because when he did the developmental movements, which he had lessons with F.M. Alexander, I think one or two, and then with another teacher, but was largely on his own, he developed a bunch of movements, borrowing from other people in that field, that he used to help restore poise. But what was different in how he looked at it was that he was no longer just recapitulating the past, but he recognized that in coming upright, we were poised. He had a concept of upright poise and balance, and he knew that the developmental movements were going to help you to achieve balanced upright poise. And that made it very interesting, because now he reverted to some of the ideas of the earlier developmental people, but he also had a kind of a more of an end goal of what you were aiming for.
All right.
And that's pretty interesting.
Yeah. It's interesting that he would have, like, in modern human beings, he would have upright posture, fully upright posture as a telos, as like an end goal, like you said, whereas in like Australopithecus, this early human who's existing like 3 million years ago was fully upright. And, you know, you wouldn't think that, he would conclude the same thing about that, you know, about that being, you know, that she would have to, you know, think about it or achieve it somehow. It's, you know, it's interesting to me how he, you know, it seems like an irony in his theory, or like a, you know, like a, that's like true, a contradiction.
Yeah, it's true. He perhaps because of the influence of Alexander, he knew that he felt that modern humans were degenerating. That reflects a little bit of an idea of Alexander's. He said, we're all bespectacled, sedentary, hunched over, and so that we had to relearn and rethink how we utilize our upright design, because we were interfering with it. Interesting. So for him, the developmental movements were a way of doing that. And so I think a component that he added to the idea of developmental movement that was not as popular among the other folks was that by utilizing earlier postures, because they were simpler and more supported, you could go back to the earlier postures to relearn and use all that feedback to regain more upright postures in progressively and consciously. And that's, you know, interesting.
Yeah.
And he also had a very in-depth, you know, kind of knowledge about upright posture as a neuro, you know, neurological, a much more complex neurological design.
Okay. Yeah. Well, yeah. And so this is more or less the topic of this episode, Ted, like this, the uniqueness of the upright human posture, you know, yeah. You know, certainly it's, you know, like Raymond Dart's relationship to it, but like the fact that upright posture is not simply bipedalism, which we see all the time. We see it in birds, you know, we see it in kangaroos, and, you know, it's not simply bipedalism. It's something different. It's its own formation. It's also, you know, it's almost its own form, which is something that we touched on a few episodes ago about forms in nature. You know, we see the wing, which is, you know, it's been developed in many different organisms and many different genuses of organisms. But like upright posture is a similar thing. It isn't simply walking on 2 feet.
Yeah, that's interesting. You mean, when you say that, James, you mean it's not simply like a modified form of four-footedness, let's say. Is that what you mean by that when you say it's not?
Yeah. Like a bear sometimes can get up on 2 feet and walk around. You know, a deer, you know, I've seen deer walking around on 2 feet. But these are four-footed creatures, you know. And human upright posture, or as Raymond Dart pointed out, like going back a long time, this is an anatomically distinct and then architecturally distinct and in every way distinct, neurologically, in an engineering sense, upright human posture is a distinct thing. And this is really the key to understanding what benefits that we can gain from developmental movement and what meaning it has.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to overstate it. It's not like he discovered that it was, Darwin talked about how Darwin spoke about humans being highly organized. In fact, other primates even. It's not like Dart was the first person. I think what he saw was he was specifically, he was aware of some of the specifics of what it meant to be upright. Mm-hmm. You know, for instance, if the foramen magnum is at the bottom of the skull, and the skull is now that, which means that the spine is below the skull and supporting it, that's a very different arrangement than a four-footed animal where this skull is sitting out in front of a horizontally placed spine. Mm-hmm. And Dart was, again, a little bit influenced by Alexander and having seen that point of view, he was aware of the importance of head balance to upright posture. And that's something you won't see in, you know, general descriptions of upright posture in humans. In, you know, that's upright posture is generally seen as just a modification in, you know, the ability of the animal to come up onto the hind legs so that the pelvis changes in shape. That was well known. The spine changes in shape. That was well known. Skull is sitting on top. That's well known. But people generally thought that the skull is sitting there kind of balanced up on top, and it's not. It's actually unevenly balanced in the same way that a skull in a four-footed animal is hanging down in front. In humans, it's not hanging down in front, but it's sitting on top, but it's balanced, counterbalancing other muscles. And I think Dart saw that that upright posture was a dynamic system that could go out of balance, and he appreciated how to get it back into balance. And that's an appreciation he had. He also, when he wrote about, you know, let's say the relation of eyes to head balance, He was linking well-established neurological knowledge about the coordination of eyes with head movement, but he saw it in an evolutionary perspective as part of the evolution of a design in which the ability to coordinate incoming visual information with head movements and head balance and coordinating total body movements to aid the animal or the human in getting food, all of that, he began to see it as a much more dynamic system that needed to be trained and needed more learning. That's amazing. Mm. Kind of an interesting, almost like he was had an a beginning of an educational perspective on what it meant to achieve and master upright poise. Kind of an amazing idea.
Yeah, the fact that it's even necessary. You know, I mean, that's a real leap of insight. You know, the fact that it's even necessary to master upright poise. You know,
well, we can't fully credit him. It's from Alexander. I mean, I think that he, having had those lessons, you know, when he wrote about it, he wrote the papers that Dart wrote on this subject were kind of honoring Alexander. So that's important to mention. But he appreciated it. He incorporated his own knowledge of anatomy into the study of that. And he had insights about it that as far as I know are unique. I mean, like the insight about how the whole system is hung from the head and global systems. This doesn't come from body work or later work. It comes from Raymond Dart. He's, as far as I know, he's the first person who saw that muscles from the skull are spiraling around the trunk, and that in a sense, the things are not just stacked up from below, but everything's hung from above. So you have this suspensory system. That's an incredible appreciation of the dynamic complexity of upright poise.
Yeah, and situating Dart properly, the topic of this episode isn't Raymond Dart. It's human upright posture. You know, that's the real interesting thing here. And situating Dart, Raymond Dart. You know, for people who are unfamiliar with this subject, you know, this is just another name. For people who are into, say, like Alexander technique, this is quite a big name. But to situate him properly, I mean, he was an interesting, his work as an anatomist was important in anthropology, it turns out. It's like, you know, he like helped to identify fossilized skulls as human, an early form of human. It wasn't unique. He helped therefore to situate what it means to be human, or the proper lineage of humanity.
He became the most famous figure in anthropology in his time
once the obstacles were removed, you know, like once the racist
he wasn't an anthropologist, but he became massively famous because of his discovery his claim.
This is an important figure. But really the interesting thing is the upright posture. It's the human upright posture. And what you said before, Ted, like this is maybe, I don't know, like the topic of the uniqueness of the human upright posture maybe is more proper for like a different episode. But like you mentioned before, sort of in passing, that part of the theory of the day was that humans had gained a large brain first and then utilize the intelligence to go upright. You know, that was sort of the theory of the day.
I don't know if they were utilized, but yeah, but it's sort of, let's just say, I don't know, it proceeded.
It's a really strange theory. It was an incoherent theory. But you know, this discovery of this what otherwise looked like a baboon skull with a bottom situated foramen magnum makes it clear that in the human lineage it was upright posture that was first.
Clearly, you know? Yeah.
And that's very interesting.
The anthropologists of the day wanted to kind of preserve the idea that humans were different, you know, that we weren't just like other animals. And they also wanted to preserve the idea that they were white. So there was being different was also, you know, began with being white or something. Yeah. And those were wrong, you know, it shifted that, it challenged it. He put anthropology in a different track, which is good. Mm-hmm. The upright posture, I think that what's so interesting is that now if you look at developmental movement as a useful way to make, to integrate functions and to gain greater, you know, kinesthetic awareness and control, let's say, mm-hmm. in being upright, now we have a more developed idea of what it means to be upright that you can both aim toward and bring to the practice. And there, I think that circularity is important, because how do you know how to approach crawling, let's say, if you don't know how crawling works in a four-footed animal and in a human? How human upright posture is a variation of crawling or four-footedness. How can you approach crawling if you don't understand that relationship? And how can you get the full benefit from it if you don't understand where it's going? So I've seen people do crawling and all around the room, and it's like becomes like a form of exercise, and they think it gives them an experience that's different. And then when they stand up, they feel different, and they describe how it's different. And meanwhile, they haven't actually helped themselves in their upright poise at all. In fact, if anything, it could get quite harmful and quite kind of indulgent in a way. And here you have a much more nuanced view of how to look at the whole process in an educational context, and then, you know, along with that, you can look at, let's say, crawling and see it as a dynamic set of relationships. And what are those dynamic relationships? Well, in a human upright posture, the head is not just sitting on top of the spine, but it's balanced in such a way that muscles are lengthening within bony structures, within the context of their bony attachments. The spine tends to lengthen, which is paradoxical, because muscles in the human being look like all they could do is pull the thing down. And yet we are designed to let go into length. You could look at how muscles unwind. That's a bit of an insight that Dart had, that everything spirals so that when we let go upwardly, we're also tend to untwist if we've gotten into a twist. Mm-hmm. You could look at all the different parts and how they relate to other parts, because now you're looking at the whole structure dynamically. So now you could, when you assume a crawling position, you could look at it dynamically and begin in a better state, benefit from it, and apply it to becoming upright.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it becomes a really rich kind of way of looking at it. And Alexander didn't do that. You know, Alexander, as far as we know, he didn't, except for perhaps getting people to lie down, which is a kind of a developmental procedure because it's going back to a more supported primitive posture. Apart from that, he didn't actively refer to developmental procedures. And here we can use them much more, you know, openly as a way of helping people when they're having trouble and need to learn more.
Yeah. And that's the stamp right there. That's, you know, Raymond Dart as a theorist in this subject, and then you as a theorist in this subject. I feel like that's your real stamp on what the meaning of development a developmental movement is, what the use to be made of it is. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's just important, you know, I think, you know, for listeners to be, you know, to be clear about this.
Yeah.
There's a lot of developmental movement out there. there's a lot of developmental movement out there. I know, I sometimes, you know, in private conversations, Ted, you know, I've told you, I somewhat object to that phrase. I like wish that we could think of a different name to call it, because it, you know, to me, it seems like very embedded in this theory that if you, you know, get into certain postures and make certain movements, then you can recapitulate things, or you can like, you know, use postures in a sort of jury rigged way to like make changes in the brain and the nervous system, which was the theory of the day in the 70s. Yeah. Your view is very different than this. Very different than this. It's distinct and it's clear. I just like want people to, you know, like pause now and reflect, you know, like this, yeah, almost, you know?
Well, yeah. So, you know, Raymond Dart, he, I've learned a lot from his ideas. I love his, you know, kind of free thinking. He was very offbeat. He came up with other ideas and wrote papers on other topics that are interesting. When it came to developmental movement, he reverted, as I mentioned earlier, a little bit to the idea that if you recapitulate that one reason why as adults we're often not in a very good state is because we haven't gone through the earlier stages. And I don't quite see it that way. That's the old developmental idea that if you, I don't know, let's say if you're not standing fully upright, it's maybe because you didn't crawl properly and you need to go through that stage. And if you go through that stage, now you'll stand upright. I think there's more to it than that. And I think we need more, more knowledge about how to have a command of upright posture, or what I call sensory motor awareness, as a kind of a field and a curriculum. Mm. We need more knowledge of that in order to go back to these movements and utilize them effectively.
Okay. So Ted, so we want to wrap up here. And you know, we want to segue into what we're going to be talking about over the next few episodes. And there's so much that comes out of this particular subject, you know, we can go off in a lot of different ways here. And I think the next few episodes, maybe the next handful of episodes, are going to be topics that came up during the last four episodes.
Hmm.
And I, you know, we were just talking about the uniqueness of the human upright form. And, you know, I think, can you say more about where we're going to go with that for the, you know, for our next talk?
Yeah, I think it might be interesting, since you know, we're talking about upright form as a way of looking at developmental movement as a kind of foundational knowledge for it. I think it'd be interesting to look at the vertebrate design, and you mentioned mm-hmm. that just now as well, James. Look at our the specific anatomical features of our upright vertebrate design. Mm-hmm. How they come out of earlier vertebrate designs, but they aren't simply modifications, but go toward higher order functional systems that, in a way, I don't think we fully appreciate, because we tend to look at everything as a, you know, when we look at things as modifications from something earlier, that's useful. It's explanatory in some ways, mm-hmm. but it doesn't fully explain, let's say, what it means to have an arm and a hand as in our human form.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we could talk about that.
Great. And then in later episodes, we'll even talk about, you know, perhaps some more philosophical things about something that you mentioned in this episode, was that, you know, the practice of developmental movement, you sort of have to have in mind an understanding of the human upright form. Then you have to go back sort of, you know, to other earlier forms, but still with an understanding of the human upright form in order to make proper use. But you're going toward the restoration of the function of the human upright form. So it's this sort of circularity, you know. This is something that, you know, that we've spoken about and that, you know, that we can maybe delve more into sort of the circularity of understanding that's like required in order to make practical use of these things.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay.
So like and subscribe. This is going to be on YouTube and this is going to be on your preferred podcast platform, but leave us a review. It helps us out a lot. But this has been the Awareness Connection. Thank you so much, Ted. Always appreciate
being here. Thank you, James. Thank you all.
Thanks, everybody.